Welcome to the Dermatology Interest Group Association podcast, or DIGA podcast, where we talk about everything from how to become a stellar dermatology applicant to interesting topics in dermatology.
From research advice to interviewing tips, you will be prepared to follow the path to become a world-class dermatologist.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm your host, Grace Hobayan. Today, I talk with Dr. Eva Parker, a dermatologist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. We have an amazing in-depth discussion on climate change and its effect on dermatologic health, and much more. Without further ado, see you on the skin side. All right, everyone. Welcome back to the DIGA podcast. I'm here with Dr. Eva Parker, and she's going to introduce herself.
Hi, Grace. Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. And I am Dr. Eva Parker. I'm an assistant professor of dermatology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. I'm also core faculty in the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society. Grace asked me to say where I went to school. So I did my undergraduate in environmental science at the University of Denver, and I did medical school at the University of Colorado. I did my internship in internal medicine at St. Joseph's Hospital in Denver, and then I did my residency at Northwestern in Chicago. Right out of the gates of residency, I practiced in academics, and then I had a long stint, a little bit more than a decade, in private practice, where I was a practice partner, and then came back to academics 4 years ago and have been at Vanderbilt since then. And my primary academic interests are global health and effects of climate change on health.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining the DIGA podcast today. I'm super excited to talk with you about global health and climate change as it applies to dermatology. And so you mentioned that you got an undergrad degree in environmental science at the University of Denver. Sounds like this is sort of the origin story of where this all started. So can you tell our listeners how you became interested in pursuing this major back then?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was really fortunate to have parents who really valued nature and thought that it was important for us as human beings to have a connection to that. And so that was always fostered by my dad, especially growing up. And we grew up in a more rural area, often going on long hikes and walks in the woods. And it was an amazing way for me to connect with nature and realize that at the same time that we had all this beauty around us, humans were impacting the environment negatively, and I wanted to do something about that. And I really thought I wanted to be an environmental attorney, which is why I went to undergrad pursuing environmental science, but I ended up shifting courses late in undergraduate and going to medical school instead. But as you can see, sort of come full circle, because now one of my main academic interests and one of the things that I'm an expert in is climate effects on health in general, but also on skin health specifically.
Yeah, that's interesting. You started thinking about law school and then switched over to medicine. I'm wondering what pushed you towards the medicine side of it.
So it was a few things. First, my father passed away from cancer when I was 12. And so I had been thinking that I wanted to do some volunteer work with cancer patients, just sort of as a way to not only give back, but I think I was also looking for some avenues to sort of repair some of my own feelings of grief that had lingered after all those years. So late in college, I started volunteering on a cancer ward, and I was just sitting with patients and chatting with them, and, you know, would get small things for them if they needed ice or water or a snack. And it was really eye-opening. And I realized that in myself, I'm very much a people person. And one of the things that drives me is a deep sense of empathy. And that in addition to loving science, I really wanted to do more to help people in the world. And I realized that perhaps being an attorney wasn't the best avenue for me to accomplish that and for me to satisfy those passions and to really have those connections that are meaningful with people.
Mm-hmm. I think I had a very similar, somewhat similar experience myself. I was an engineering major, biomedical engineering. And so what was really impactful for me was I had a professor who said that as an engineer, you're creating medical devices for patients, but there's a glass wall between you and the patients. If you're a doctor, there's no glass wall. You can have those empathetic connections with patients, and the rest is history.
Yeah, exactly. Well said, Grace.
So in medical school, what were some of the factors that led you to pursue dermatology?
So it's funny because, you know, after doing this volunteer work with cancer patients, I came home and said to my then fiance, I think I want to go to medical school and I think I actually want to be a dermatologist. And he was like, okay, great. Sort of, I think he felt it was a little bit out of the blue, but for me, I have had psoriasis since I was 2 years old, as has my brother since he was a young child too. And so growing up with skin disease has always been something that impacted me in maybe ways that were unsaid and weren't necessarily talked about when I was a child in terms of self-esteem and some of the limitations to activities that I could pursue because of my palmar plantar psoriasis and how painful it was, especially on my feet. And in interacting with those cancer patients, I realized, oh my God, I've like had this terrible skin disease my whole life. I could actually go to medical school and help people and do something about it and perhaps even connect with those patients more than an average physician could because I know exactly what they're experiencing. And what's funny in med school is I'm really one of those people that love everything. And so in med school, I loved every rotation I did, and I considered every single thing, at least for a few minutes, if not more than that. But I kept coming back to dermatology, realizing that a lot of the things that I loved in medicine, I could do in dermatology every day. You know, you get to deal with complex diseases, you get to deal with systemic manifestations, you get to deal with infections, drug reactions. You see people of all ages and at all stages. There's a ton of mental health issues that impact dermatology, and skin disease conversely impacts mental health issues, pathology. I mean, the list goes on and on, surgical procedures, cosmetics. And so I realized that, man, I can do dermatology and get to do all of those aspects of medicine that I really love.
Yeah. I always got the question as a third year med student of, do you want to do internal medicine or do you want to do surgery? And I always said, well, I don't really know because I like aspects of both. And it turns out, well, dermatology's got it all. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When you were applying to dermatology residency, I'm wondering if climate change and environmental science played a factor in deciding where to apply for residency, or were there other factors that were very important to you when you went into the application process?
Well, now you're going to make me confess that I'm old. And so, you know, in the late 90s, when I was in med school, no one was really talking about health impacts from climate change. There may have been a few conversations here and there with like specific like chemical spills or accidents. Like, you know, I'm thinking about the Bhopal explosion that released toxic chemicals or Love Canal, but no one was talking about the everyday impacts of environmental degradation and climate change and how that broadly affects everyone's health. So it wasn't really a topic that was front and center. And it wasn't really until maybe 5 years ago that I was noticing the impacts personally in my patients and began to look for like-minded folks who were seeing the same. So really my environmental background didn't play a role per se. I mean, I already had a strong science foundation to apply to medical school because environmental science has so much biology and chemistry as part of its curriculum. But in terms of actually its role in me going to med school or even residency, it didn't really factor in. And I would have to pull it out. I think I still have a copy somewhere, but I'm pretty sure on my ARS application when I was applying for dermatology that I did use an analogy between skin and soil. So I have a minor in geology and did a lot of research and work on soil and its geochemical properties, as well as how it plays a role, important role in ecological systems. And one thing about soil is when you when you dig into soil and create a cross section of different layers of soil, it really tells a very important story. And the analogy that I used was how those layers of soil are very much like the layers of skin, which also tell a very important story, especially from a histological standpoint when you're looking through the microscope and determining the type of inflammation and the location of inflammation. So I'm pretty sure I used that as my analogy in my ARS application years ago.
That's such a cool analogy. And when you, I'm sure you might have also taken this further with when you have plants in the ground, you know, there's roots coming up and there's a lot of factors determining whether the plant is healthy, depending on whether the soil and its layers are healthy. So
Exactly. Yeah.
And so what were the other things that you considered as far as where to apply for residency? And what were some of the other things you did to craft a strong application?
So because I made this pivot late in college that I wanted to do medical school, I really wanted to do it primarily because I wanted to do dermatology. I stepped into medical school already having a strong sense of connection to that specialty. And while I entertained other things, it really was always sort of front and center for me in terms of what I wanted to pursue. So from the get-go, I started working with a gentleman in dermatology doing research, and I would follow him sometimes when my schedule allowed to clinic as well, and would do some clinical work with him. But that was, I think, a very important step for me to get in early on doing research in dermatology. I think it's very much in vogue and even encouraged these days to take a year off between third and fourth year of medical school and do a research year. But 20 years ago, that wasn't really commonly done. And it was, I wouldn't say frowned upon per se, but it made people pause and be like, why are you doing that? And so for me at that time, it was really important that I incorporated research from an early stage. And that allowed me to get to know members of the faculty in the Department of Dermatology at the University of Colorado very well. And I was a well-known entity by the time I was entering fourth year and applying to residencies. And that allowed me to get, I think, very strong letters of recommendation. In addition, I did research with Bob Della Valle at University of Colorado later, and that allowed me to do well, let me back up and say my original research in dermatology was more bench-based research. And then partnering with Dr. Della Valle a little bit later in med school allowed me to do more research that was epidemiology-based. We did a really cool study, and it was the first time I had ever collaborated with others outside of medicine. And I have to say it was incredibly energizing and eye-opening, and something that I now enjoy doing is a paper that we did assessing tanning laws and access for minors. And we did it for every state in the US, along with Canada, France, Australia, and New Zealand. And we partnered with folks at the University of Denver Law School. And it was such a cool, it was a really cool collaboration. So partnering with him a little bit later also allowed me to get a different type of dermatology exposure and experience, which I think made my application well-rounded.
Yeah, that sounds like another sort of full circle type of project where you originally had this interest in law school and you're able to do this really, really interesting project that involves law and lots of different disciplines to look at something very important. It's very impressive. You're able to look at the whole world almost with the differences in tanning laws. I'm wondering what has come of this project.
So it was published. It was a very old study at this point, but it was published. I can get you, if you want to post it with the podcast, I can always get the link to it. But I think it ended up being rather foundational for a number of arguments to pursue outlawing tanning beds or restricting tanning bed access for minors. I mean, part of the premise of what we were saying is, you can't go and buy a pack of cigarettes because they're carcinogenic when you're a child. So why would we let children lay in tanning beds when it's equally carcinogenic? And now it's pretty widespread throughout the United States that there are limits on minors' access to tanning beds, which is a huge win. And I think this paper helped to solidify the need for that push on a state level.
Mm-hmm. That's a very great point about there being the equal carcinogenic effects between smoking cigarettes and tanning beds. And I think it's such an impressive impact that you've made with the work that you've done here.
And thank you. Yeah, it was a cool project.
Yeah, for sure. And so with your extensive research experience, it sort of tracks with your involvement in your choice to pursue academic medicine. And I know that you had mentioned going into private practice for a time. I'm wondering what the ultimate motivations were for initially going into academic medicine, then going into private practice, and then going back into academic medicine to stay for the long term, to teach the next generation of dermatologists.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do love teaching, and that was a primary driver for me to go into academics right out of residency. And on top of that, I love complex medical dermatology. I love the opportunity to collaborate with other specialties. And while you can certainly do some complex med derm in private practice, it's limited. It's more limited in what you're able to see and manage effectively. And I really enjoyed especially complex patients like transplant patients and patients who had HIV with more advanced skin disease. And those are just populations that don't necessarily infiltrate private practice to the same degree that you would find those patients getting services from an academic center. And so those were really my primary motivations for wanting to do academics, is the complexity of patients and the ability to teach. You know, there's, again, I'm dating myself, but nobody talked about burnout early on in my career. That's, you know, been a much more recent conversation and honestly a desperately needed conversation. But you can't do everything at once and be everything to everyone. But when I started in academics, I was working 5 days a week in clinic. I was seeing incredibly complex patients, including running a transplant clinic. And we did have a pediatric dermatologist, but he only worked a half day a week. And so I ended up seeing a lot of complex peds cases, as well as a large number of autoimmune blistering diseases. I was also running the consult service. So I did consults in the hospital after clinic 5 days a week, every week. And also we had a brand new residency program, and I was the associate director of the residency program and largely developing the curriculum and taking that program to the next level fell on my shoulders in addition to all of the clinical work. And so I found myself honestly working sometimes 120 hours a week. Come home, I mean, I would chart till midnight. Just, it was very, very hard. And I just burned out really quickly. And I would never want to go back and trade those years, because number one, it gave me a tremendous amount of confidence right out of residency, dealing with really complex patients. Just helped me to understand that if I walked in the room and didn't know what it was, that I had the tools in my toolbox to figure it out and help that patient. And so that was super valuable for me. And I learned a lot about what I needed to do going forward to advocate for myself better and to manage, I think, expectations better. And also to, this was really eye-opening, but, and if you know of an academic center that isn't this way, please let me know. But unfortunately in academics, as there is in medicine in any situation, but especially in academics, there is a lot of bureaucracy and red tape. And I was young and very idealistic, and I thought for sure I would be able to easily change some things and things that seemed really pragmatic and obvious and common sense that I advocated for were constantly shot down in favor of either not changing at all or doing something in a much less efficient, more expensive way that didn't better patient care. And I think as an idealist, that was incredibly frustrating. So between the burnout and just frustrations, I decided I needed to leave and take a step back and do something different for a while. And a lot of my complex patients followed me, which was great. I still got to do, see many of them because I practiced in the same city for a time. And then it was time for us to leave Chicago and we wanted to move back to Nashville. And so we decided to return home to Nashville. What's interesting, and I wouldn't discourage anyone from pursuing this model per se, but I do think it's important to understand structure in academics if that's the path that you're going to take. And initially, when I was in academics, we were part of a division under the Department of Medicine. That was very different than when I was a resident, when we were our own independent department. I really do think putting dermatology under medicine or under any other specialty is much like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Because while we do a lot of complex medicine, we're high volume. We also do a lot of procedures and a lot of cosmetics. And so we don't necessarily fit well under medicine because there's no other specialty within medicine that's quite like that. And we're much too medically oriented to fit under surgical subspecialties. And so what became very apparent to me was advocating for needs of our residents and our division was much more challenging than if we had been an independent department. So long story short, when we moved back to Nashville to be close to family 13 years ago, Vanderbilt was the only academic center here in Nashville, and they were a division under the Department of Medicine. And I just felt, given my prior experience, that it wasn't the right time for me to re-enter academics. And so instead, I joined a private practice. And I have to say that, again, I don't regret doing that. I really got to cut my teeth on how to manage the business side of medicine. And I can't tell you how valuable having those skills are, because regardless of what type of medicine you practice, medicine is a business, and understanding operational efficiency, understanding overhead and bottom lines, and being able to read a P&L statement and comprehending the enormous task of managing HR are just incredibly valuable no matter what you do. And so, I am grateful for having that opportunity to learn that. But as time went on, I really was missing the complexity of patients and teaching and the collaborations that I used to have. And at the same time, I was much more concerned about climate effects on health and felt like it was perhaps the right time for me to pivot again and go back to academics. And it was great timing because at Vanderbilt, we had become a department and we were no longer a division. And so I felt like structurally, from an administrative standpoint and a bureaucratic standpoint, it would be a much better fit for me now to potentially join Vanderbilt. So that's what I did. And that was in 2019.
Oh, so not too long ago, but
Long ago.
Yeah. And I think you make a really good point about the business side of medicine. It's not something that med students get hardly any exposure to. And a lot of it seems like we have to eventually teach ourselves if that is something we want to incorporate in our practice in any way. What were some of the resources that you used to learn about this?
Yes. So I read a lot of business books and listened to a lot of business podcasts. I remember listening a lot to the Harvard Business Case Study podcasts. And there's a number of business and medicine podcasts as well. And my husband has owned his own business for a very long time. And so often I would bounce ideas off of him. And he came from the corporate world and has worked for a number of Fortune 500 companies. And so I think he had a very good sense of business in general. And he's very good at extrapolating problems. You know, there's a saying, there's no such thing as new problems in business. There's just new solutions. And so it doesn't really matter whether you're in medicine or you own a print shop or a restaurant. there's many commonalities in running a business and issues that traverse different types of sectors. And so he was very good too about really being a sounding board. And so it was trial and error and being curious and trying to learn and read and talking to other friends who were in private practice, especially in dermatology, and how they handled and managed issues as they arose. And I think what I learned most is that it requires a fair amount of flexibility, adaptability, creativity, and a good bit of risk-taking.
Yeah, all very, very important skills, even if you don't go into private practice. It's all very applicable to many cases in academics as well. And so now that you're back in the academic sphere, and I wanted to say, with the original workload that you had the first time you were in academics, that you had a lot on your plate. That's very, very impressive that whatever it took, you were able to ultimately balance all of that. I'm wondering what a typical week looks like now in your academic practice.
Yeah, so it's much more reasonable.
Yeah.
I did learn some lessons, as I said. You know, it was an important experience for me to learn how to advocate for myself. And now, fortunately, there's much more acknowledgement of how burdensome the workload can be in medicine. And there's much more willingness to talk about having some balance and minimizing burnout. So it's a much easier conversation now than it was 20 years ago when I was in the throes of this. But for me now, I see patients a total of 3 days a week. You know, it's 6 half days, if you will. I have a fair amount of procedural time where I do skin excisions, EDNCs, and cosmetics. And so those patients are templated every 30 minutes. And always the charting on a procedure is going to be less than it is for a complex med derm patient. And then I have gen derm the other 2 days, or the other 2 half days a week. And then on top of that, I do about 3 months of inpatient consults. That's spread across the year, and I do about a week a month. And so that's on top of my clinic schedule, but doing a week a month is very different than doing every day, every week, all year right. long. And so those weeks, I definitely am much more intentional about not booking extra meetings and really trying to lighten my load, knowing that when I finish clinic, I'm going to have to head to the hospital to see patients. But on my 2 afternoons, the latest I see patients is 2:30. So I'm able to get to the hospital at a reasonable hour and round with our residents. I have some specialty clinics that are mixed in. So I am an attending at Nashville General Hospital. It is an affiliated hospital with Vanderbilt. We see largely patients with Medicare insurance or no insurance. So underserved and uninsured patients. And I'm an attending there, the half-day clinic, and I do that once a month. And then twice a month, I have an HIV dermatology clinic in our comprehensive care center, which is what it sounds like, comprehensive care for people living with HIV here in Middle Tennessee. And I do once a month volunteer at a clinic here in Nashville called Siloam Health. They've been here for 30 years, and they largely care for uninsured patients, but specifically migrants and refugees. And it's a huge joy for me to be able to do that clinic. And I do that on a Saturday morning once a month. And then when there's a need, I attend at the Shade Tree Clinic, which is also usually on a Saturday. And it's our student-run free clinic for underserved patients here in Nashville. So that's sort of how my weeks shake out. It's may sound like a lot, but it's not nearly the volume that it was before. And that gives me much more time to pursue academic interests and be able to publish and collaborate and write and do those things that I find deeply fulfilling that really fill my tank and drive me and push me forward.
Yeah, sounds much more balanced, and you sound very much in your element with the different settings in which you see complex derm patients and pursuing your research interest as well.
It's been good.
And so at Vanderbilt, you're also, as you mentioned earlier, you're one of the core faculty in the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society. And you also founded, you also co-founded the Environmental Sustainability Working Group at Vanderbilt.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about these groups.
Sure. The Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society is an amazing center. It's a large group of faculty who have ethical interests and ethical backgrounds, and very diverse group, many different specialties, including several attorneys. And the center's work is pretty wide ranging, with many of the individual core faculty members having their own specific subset of interests within biomedical ethics. My major interests within that realm are the ethics of climate change and health equity. And we have, you know, monthly meetings that range from case presentations. We have a very active biomedical ethics consultation service for the hospital. And so there's really some very challenging ethical issues that come up. And it's really fascinating to work through those and to consider all of the different angles. And no two cases are ever alike. And it just shows, I think it's a real testament to the complexity of what we have to do as physicians and the medical decision-making that goes in, not only on our part, but on the part of patients and their families, to arrive at a decision that is best for the patient and most appropriate for the patient. So those are incredibly interesting. And some of our meetings also are involve faculty research presentations and learning about what our faculty are doing. Specifically for me, and I mentioned climate change and health equity, and part of what I do in the center is offer a semester-long graduate-level course for health sciences students that focuses on health, ecology, and climate change. And that is a really fun course. It's very interdisciplinary, and we explore a lot of topics as it intersects with health and climate change. And then also the center has a program called Rooted Community Health. And it's really very interesting. I'm not sure many biomedical ethics divisions or centers have something so unique, but we actually partner with CSAs here in Tennessee. And what we're able to do is to either fully fund or deeply discount fresh, healthy food for Vanderbilt employees. And this is, I think it's a really awesome thing that we're able to do. And in addition to that, we have a community garden on campus as well.
Wow. That really is unique. It makes me think that, you know, more programs should have that in the future, but it's very fortunate that you have that for sure. In addition to what you do within Vanderbilt University, you're also on the Sustainability Advisory Committee for the mayor of Nashville.
Correct.
What have your experiences been like, and how did you get involved with that?
So I was invited to be on the committee. It is co-chaired by someone who is at Vanderbilt University. And just to clarify for people who don't know the structure here, Vanderbilt University and Vanderbilt University Medical Center are actually separate financial and academic institutions. Although we're closely linked in many ways, we actually are separate entities. And so one of the chairs of the committee is at Vanderbilt University, and the other co-chair is an environmental attorney in DC who's based here in Nashville, but her husband is also an environmental attorney in the law school. And so I have just some connections with them through the environmental work that I do, and they invited me. And interestingly, it's a large committee. I think we're 60 or 70 members, and I'm the only physician.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how broad the impacts are from climate and health, and that we don't have more healthcare representation on the committee. But nevertheless, it's been a really interesting journey. Of course, Mayor Cooper is not going to run for office again, and so we're not really sure what will happen with the next election and whether the committee will continue on or be restructured. I certainly hope that it's the former and that I get to stay in the role, but some of the things that I've worked on are public engagement for funding around environmental justice measures for the city. So they're starting to do some public engagement on budgeting, and they've piloted a few programs where they have taken a sum of money and said to a community, okay, we're going to give you this money. How do you want it spent? What do you think are the needs and the projects that this money should be invested in? And so now we're starting to parlay that into specifically environmental justice, which has been really interesting. Also, things I'm less involved in, but there's a number of other initiatives on this committee, including engagement with business and sustainability measures, and also engagement with the public in general, and especially around education.
I also hope that the next mayor will continue having this committee, because I think you're touching on very important issues, especially, as you said, with education and just environmental health in general. And I think your role as a physician, as the only physician in that group of 60 or 70, is quite pivotal, especially as it pertains to the health of your community. Circling back to Vanderbilt, I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the Vanderbilt Dermatology Residency Program, and as well as just the city of Nashville in general.
Oh, absolutely. So our dermatology program is amazing, in case you didn't know that already. Yes. and I think our program director, Annie DeWan, has been on in the recent past this podcast and has talked about applicants and, you know, sort of what we look for. But I'm very proud. We have a very diverse residency, and our residents get a broad exposure, which I think is so key to coming out being very well-rounded as a dermatologist and being able to confidently tackle skin disease of any type. And in addition, we have a lot of subspecialty exposure. So for those who are interested in doing a fellowship, there's ample opportunity to get exposure to various subspecialties of dermatology that position you very well to make an informed decision about pursuing fellowship. So we have three dermatopathologists, which is amazing, and they're all brilliant. We have two people, who Dr. Zick and Dr. Zwerner, who specialize in cutaneous lymphoma. We have, currently two Mohs surgeons, with a third one joining us in a few months, which is amazing, because then there is a lot of exposure to procedural dermatology in general. There's several of us who do cosmetics, and so there's broad exposure to filler, Botox, and laser. And then Dr. Ellis specializes in pigmented lesions and does a lot with dermoscopy. So there's very rich training there as well. We, of course, have a very busy and robust consult service. So there's all of our residents spend two full months in their second year on inpatient consults. But in addition, there is weekend coverage and night coverage throughout first year that they also do. And so there is really tremendous exposure to complex med derm and inpatient dermatology. I mentioned I do HIV dermatology, and so our residents rotate with me for that. We also have several room derm multidisciplinary clinics. We have one for adults that Dr. Miller does with one of our rheumatologists. And then we also have a pediatric one that Dr. Smith does with one of the pediatric rheumatologists. And speaking of Dr. Smith, residents routinely rotate with him for pediatric dermatology as well. So really, if you're looking for amazing med derm, complex derm, path, surgery, cosmetics, and subspecialty interests, then you'll definitely find it here at our program. And then we also, you know, we also have the opportunity to do underserved care at our clinic at Nashville General Hospital, which is also very much resident driven. And then Nashville. Nashville's a fun place. It is my hometown. I am a Nashville native, which now makes me a unicorn because there are so many people that have moved to Nashville from elsewhere because it's such a beautiful place. Green rolling hills. If you're an outdoorsy person, there's so much to do: hiking, whitewater rafting, other outdoor activities, cycling that are so close by. We have a number of large parks that are still within city limits, which are beautiful and amazing. And there's quite a food scene here in Nashville. It's certainly been burgeoning for a long time, but you will not go hungry here. And we have we're Music City USA. So we have amazing live music and many concert venues, but also many small venues if you're interested in live music. And it's not just country music. We have a very rich blues and jazz scene here as well, and a large number of rock concerts that come through, and even smaller venues as well for rock music. And then we have a wonderful art scene here. You know, I think if you come from a place like Chicago or New York, it may not compare to that, but our Frist Art Museum is really exceptional. And not only are the collections exceptional, but it's in a beautiful example of Art Deco architecture in a building that was our original main post office that when it closed was repurposed into an art museum. So architecturally, it's beautiful. And then the collections are amazing. But we have a number of art galleries and art crawls that take place not only here in Nashville, but in Franklin, which is a suburb just to the south of us where dermatology also has a satellite office. So that's just a few little tidbits of how fabulous Nashville is. And if you hate winter, we have a pretty decent one. We don't get a lot of snow, and it gets cold, but it's not usually cold for long and sustained periods. So if you're weather averse, specifically to cold weather, this is a good place to be.
Yeah. And it sounds like there's not a whole lot of ice that forms on the roads either.
We occasionally get a bad ice storm, but it's like once every 4 years. So,
okay. Yeah.
You know, residency is only 3 years. You might just miss that cycle.
There you go. Yeah. I visited Nashville a couple of times when I was in high school, and I've just been wanting to come back ever since.
It's a great place. And I have an extra bedroom. So you always have a place to stay, Grace.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. And so going back to climate change and environmental health, you mentioned earlier how it was only about 5 years ago that you really started seeing the environmental effects on dermatologic health with your patients. What are some of the most common environment-induced dermatologic health effects faced by patients that you see in your practice? And what are some of the treatment approaches that you use for these?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's probably more than 5 years ago that I started seeing this, but then I kept seeing the same patterns. And I started connecting the dots about 5 years ago with respect to impacts on health. And so I think probably the most common thing I see is emergence of ticks far earlier than we used to be. So remember, I'm a Nashville native, and I said in the beginning that I grew up in a more rural area. So I've had a lot of ticks on me in my life. And I just started seeing ticks on people in January and February, which I had never seen before. And that was probably the biggest clue that our winters are no longer as long and cold as they used to be, and that ticks are able to emerge sooner and perhaps even survive over the winter better than they did historically. I also started seeing more cases and worse presentations of things like poison ivy, which is also very climate sensitive. Not only are the warmer temperatures allowing the vines to grow in excess, but also too, elevated CO2 levels in the atmosphere allow greater biomass, and that supercharges the antigenicity of poison ivy. And then because the winters aren't as cold, the vines don't die back in the way that they used to. And so we're seeing a lot more contact dermatitis from plants. Also, allergy season has gotten much worse, and it's much the same as with poison ivy. We have a longer growing season, shorter winters. Plants are exposed to higher levels of CO2, and so they're able to produce more pollen and pollen for longer. And what used to be a bad spring allergy season, for many people now, it's year-round allergies. And so I'm seeing effects of that with atopic dermatitis flares, especially, much more than I used to. And also our summers are getting progressively hotter. And as a result, I'm seeing a lot more heat-related dermatoses, things like Grover's disease, intertrigo, tinea pedis, folliculitis, and other inflammatory and infectious skin diseases that are amplified by heat and humidity. Also, too, I'm seeing just in general more like staph and strep infections, especially in the summer. And again, that's probably driven by heat and humidity. That's just a snapshot of some of the things I've observed in my own clinics over time.
Yeah, I have pollen allergies myself, and I would be wondering why am I feeling this like longer than the, you know, the springtime? And that does make sense. I know we were talking earlier about the perks of not having cold weather, but now there's also the very real issues caused by global warming and how that these conditions that have already been around for a while, but now they're becoming a lot more prevalent with the heat, the humidity, and the longer growing season for plants. And it's also very scary to hear about the ticks being more prevalent in the winter months as well. So definitely a lot to watch out for. I'm wondering if the environmental health effects on the skin vary between different geographic regions of the world.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And on top of that, there's disproportionate impacts among vulnerable and marginalized populations. So regionally, you know, what we see here in Tennessee is much more severe storms like thunderstorms and flooding related to that, or tornadoes, or air pollution and heat. You know, we don't have hurricanes because we're not coastal, but you can think about the East Coast and the Gulf Coast being much more impacted by hurricanes, and places like the West Coast being much more impacted by wildfires. And when you look at a map globally, you can see that there will be regional differences in impacts. Some places are going to have much more issues with heavy precipitation, flooding, and storms, and others may have many more issues with, say, drought or wildfires. So yes, it definitely varies. And then the other unfortunate thing about climate change is that while we're all impacted, there's many subsets of our population who are impacted disproportionately. And often what we see is that not only are these populations the ones who contribute least to the problem of climate change, their emissions are much lower, but they also have fewer resources, especially economic resources, to adapt and to mitigate the effects that they're experiencing. And here in the U.S., in general, we see that our Black and Brown populations and those of lower socioeconomic status are disproportionately impacted. And that is honestly a reflection of structural racism. And it has to do with things like redlining that happened in the 1930s. And now we see that formerly redlined neighborhoods are urban heat islands, much more hot than other areas of the same city that now have much more green space and are predominantly white. We also see lower socioeconomic status communities and communities of color being sited closer to things like highways and industrial areas. And so those populations are disproportionately impacted by pollution as well. And so you get a double hit because it's not just heat, it's also air pollution. And globally, the global South is far more impacted by the effects of climate change than the global North. And you look at countries like the United States and the EU have historically contributed overwhelmingly to greenhouse gas emissions. And I will say in the last 20 years, it's now China who's contributing most, but historically, westernized, predominantly white countries are the ones that are primarily responsible. And so it's a double impact because many of the low and middle income countries that are disproportionately impacted don't have the financial resources to adapt in the same way. And of course, that was a huge focus of the most recent COP meeting that was held in Egypt and starting a global fund more or less for reparations. And we'll see what that ends up looking like and how that's managed and distributed. But it is a conversation that is long overdue, but is now starting to happen. And then in addition, I would say that there's a number of populations that are physiologically more vulnerable to the effects of climate change and heat and air pollution. And that includes children, especially young babies, pregnant women, and the elderly. But you also have other populations that are disproportionately impacted, like anyone who works outdoors. Also, our unhoused populations are deeply impacted and honestly completely forgotten and neglected in this conversation.
Yeah, with that exposure to the elements, you know, it's mm-hmm. it just really hammers home the importance of the many, many different social determinants of health. And there's just so much that can go unnoticed that we really, really have to pay more attention to as we progress in our care of these patients. And I'm also wondering if I guess you could say we've sort of reached the other end of the COVID-19 pandemic, but I'm wondering if the COVID-19 pandemic also played a role in the skin environmental interface in any way.
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, I think and perhaps maybe not with skin specifically, although there's emerging evidence that there was a lot of delay in care in general because of the pandemic. But specifically with COVID itself, what we saw was that those who were exposed to more air pollution actually had higher mortality rates from COVID. And it happened to be that Black populations were disproportionately exposed to higher levels of pollution. And that's part of the reason why we saw higher mortality rates in Black populations during the pandemic.
Right.
So there's very much a direct link with that. And I will say, like, people are like, why? Well, air pollution is well known to have detrimental effects on the immune system, and in particular, sort of dysregulate our immune mechanisms that fight and manage viral infections.
Yeah. And I remember taking a class in undergrad where they were talking about this particular region of the United States where I can't remember the exact numbers. I think something like 60 to 70% of the country's trash ends up in this region of the States. And so the people living in that area, of course, they're getting the brunt of so mm-hmm. many different adverse effects of pollution and you name it. Just learning about that was really sad. And it made me wonder, like, okay, something has to be done about that. And I think it, you know, physicians and of all kinds have a role to play here for sure.
I think you bring up a good point, Grace. And I think I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, part of our responsibility is to diagnose and treat disease and to be advocates for especially climate-related diseases and advocates for minimizing impact from climate change. But healthcare is also a big contributor. The healthcare sector is very carbon intensive. And in the US, healthcare contributes 10% to US greenhouse gas emissions and another 10% to non-greenhouse gas air pollution. Globally, it's a smaller number. You know, healthcare globally is not as industrialized as it is here in the US. So globally, it's about 5% that the healthcare sector contributes to overall greenhouse gas emissions. But of that 5%, the United States is contributing a quarter of that. So our healthcare delivery here in the United States not only impacts our own patients, but we're disproportionately contributing to our sector's contribution globally. And so I think it's really important to understand exactly what you were saying, that when we generate waste, especially red bag waste, which is often not segregated properly, that gets hauled off to generally a neighborhood that is of lower socioeconomic status. And often they are neighborhoods of that are communities of color. And so our own healthcare delivery is not only impacting climate change, but we're disproportionately impacting those communities with waste generation and pollution.
Right. I think about that a lot, especially in certain healthcare settings where, say, you have to make sure that the field is sterile, but also you're throwing away so many things. And, you know, just with the, you know, different machines also emitting certain greenhouse gases and what have you, it makes me think that there's, at least in our country, there's just we seem to have a bit of a more challenging time striking a balance between sterility and being wasteful in terms of subsequent environmental impacts. I'm wondering what medical students can do now to learn more about, say, for example, the skin environmental interface and striking the balance between things like sterility and its implications on the environment, and how they can get involved with helping to address these challenges.
Yeah, that's a great question, because the fact of the matter is those who are medical students now, this burden will fall disproportionately on you to manage and to have to consider and deal with. The impacts of climate change are only going to get worse with time. And we know there are intergenerational inequities, and that's true not only in society, but I definitely think that's true in medicine, is that older physicians are handing younger physicians a worse world, a less healthy world, and planetary health is human health. So how do we band together and make meaningful changes? So I think in general, medical students can participate in a variety of ways. I think number one, just look around you. Most medical students have to do QI projects. And so look around you. There's often opportunity to do a QI project that has to do with sustainability. And generally, when those projects are completed, not only have you minimized environmental footprint, but you've also likely saved the medical center money and probably improved patient care. So it's a triple win when you do a sustainability project like that. Also, I would say to join medical students for a sustainable future. And if you don't have one at your school, then you should start one, because it's an amazing organization and they're doing really wonderful work. And so those are just two examples of things that medical students can easily do. That's, I think, very approachable and not beyond the realm of possibility. The Medical Society Consortium has many opportunities to participate and to learn. And even so, even more so at their annual meeting, if you attend, you can actually go and visit with your congressional representatives and senators and advocate for climate and health issues, which is such a cool thing to do, legislative advocacy, if you haven't participated. And you're taught how to do that, and you'll be paired with more experienced people who've done it in the past. It's an amazing learning opportunity as well. And then for derm specifically, I want to mention three resources. First off, contact me. Grace, are you able to attach my email to this podcast?
Yes, I can. I can add it to the show notes.
Yeah, that's great. So please email me if you're a medical student who wants to do derm and you're interested in being more involved in climate and health related issues, because the American Academy of Dermatology's expert resource group is heavily involved. We have a number of students working with us, and we're able to do amazing things. And we're constantly looking at strategies to reduce our footprint within dermatology. And you can sign up for our listserv, you'll get our quarterly newsletter. And at our annual meeting, if you're able to attend, we do a session every year on climate and skin health. And in addition to that, our ERG meets, and we usually have abstract presentations, and it's a great meeting opportunity to learn and to network with like-minded folks in dermatology who are passionate about improving impacts of climate on health. The second opportunity is soon to be live, will be educational modules on the AAD website. Many of you who are interested in Durham may have already completed existing modules that the AAD has, but we're going to have one that is 4 modules. It's 15 cases, all focused on impacts of climate on skin disease. So it's a great way to learn about the medical aspects of this. And similarly, the Global Consortium for Climate and Health Education, which is based out of the Columbia Mailman School of Public Health, has resources on climate and health education. And they have different systems-based modules. So I guess any student could, regardless of what specialty you're interested in, learn from this. But there are 2 modules specifically for dermatology on the air pollution and impacts on autoinflammatory disease and impacts of climate effects on skin cancer.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear there's a variety of existing and soon to come resources for the skin environmental interface. I think this will be super useful for medical students, and a big shout out to medical students who are already involved in that. That's so cool. To wrap things up, I'm wondering if you have any last advice for preclinical and clinical medical students who are getting ready to apply to dermatology, and anything that you would say to your past self in medical school now that you're an attending dermatologist.
Okay, so advice for anyone who wants to do derm. I think if you have that sense that you want to do derm, the earlier you can interface with the Department of Dermatology at your medical school, the better. Try to do some research, try to write up some interesting case reports, because I think that allows you to become a known entity. And in that scenario, then faculty are better able to advocate for you and make stronger recommendations during the application process. And what would I say to my younger self? Boy, there's so many things, Grace. That's a tough question. I think that the thing that I've learned that's probably the most important is failure is okay. And in fact, it's not that I welcome failure, but I don't dread it and regret it in the way that I did, say, 20 years ago. Because what I understand keenly now about failure is that there's an immense opportunity to learn from that and to grow from that. And that's really important. And so instead of taking failure as a crushing blow, when it happens, embrace it and learn from it and grow from it and be better.
I remember a quote that I heard a long time ago. I don't remember who it was from, but it went something like, if you try to avoid failure, you will have failed by default, because failure is almost like an inevitable part of life. It's going to happen at some point. And so when you have your successes, it means you've already learned it. You already know what you were successful in. But when you fail, that is, as you said, that opportunity to learn and grow. That's the indication, like, okay, this is something to pay more attention to. And we're never going to love failure, but I think it's an important part of the growth process, no matter who you are, no matter what you do in life.
100%. And I say failure very broadly and loosely.
Sure.
Because, you know, I think as medical professionals, we're all very high functioning. So I think, you know, failure is all relative, right? But I think one element of failure is rejection. And so I would add to that, don't be afraid to ask someone to mentor you, to collaborate with you, to help you or give you advice because you're afraid they're going to say no. And there's a hockey analogy there, is that you miss 100% of the goals or shots you never take. So mm-hmm. If you don't ask the question, the answer is always no. And I find that for every 100 times I ask, maybe I get rejected 1 or 2 times. Like, it's really minuscule. So don't be afraid of that rejection either.
Mm-hmm. And I think about that a lot, how as medical professionals, we are generally very busy. And so the earlier we are in our training stages, it's like, oh, if I try to contact this potential mentor, are they going to say no because they're too busy? And I think you make a great point about that being like less likely, because as medical professionals, we're busy because we love to help. We love to help people in general. And so paying it forward for the medical students, for the next generation of physicians, I think that's really great to hear, for sure.
Absolutely. And anyone who's interested in working on climate projects, please reach out.
Dr. Parker, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the DIGA podcast today. This is such an insightful conversation. And I really hope that if our listeners aren't already involved with climate change, I hope that they can at least educate themselves a little bit more. And hopefully we'll all be in touch with you soon.
Thank you so much, Grace. The pleasure was all mine. This was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the DIGA podcast. We hope you enjoyed. Please send us any questions or comments to derminterestpod@gmail.com.
This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.